We're playing the New Zealand rock band The Found on Take It From Us as our theme tune for our mental health radio program. They're a trio of Kiwi musicians, two of whom are mental health consumers. Let's listen to some more of their track, Long Gone. Welcome to Take It From Us on a bright, breezy, sunny sort of Auckland day. And Take It From Us is brought to you by Framework and the Like Minds, Like Mind campaign. I'm your host, Sheldon Brown, and Take It From Us is the voice of mental health on Planet FM and addresses specifically reducing stigma and discrimination against people with lived experience of mental distress. And today, our subject essentially is suicide and discrimination and how those two can be linked so closely together. One goal of Like Minds is to emphasise that people with experience of mental distress have the same opportunities as everyone else to participate in society and in the everyday lives of their families and whānau. The overall goal of Like Minds is to create a New Zealand that values and includes people with lived experience of mental distress. Today's broadcast follows on from last week's show about a campaign of community action against suicide, which is launched by two mothers touched by grief and loss from suicide. We heard from Mother Maria Bradshaw last week about her conviction to get suicide out of the closet. And it's fair to say that Maria didn't mince her words about New Zealand's suicide statistics and the terrible tragedy of teen suicide, where New Zealand, in fact, ranks, I think, the highest in the developed world. Today, Maria is back in the studio with her fellow founder of the Community Action Against Suicide organisation to recount the impact of this family tragedy on her and her life, and how many authorities from hospitals, clinicians, the justice system and society in general has discriminated against her through her journey of grief and confusion over the past 3 years. So welcome, Maria, and welcome, Deb. You're here as a support person, but fellow founder of CASPR.
Thank you very much, Sheldon. It's great to be here talking about suicide. Thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, well, great to meet you. I've met Maria on a couple of occasions and spoken to her on the phone while you were both camping, I think, just north of Taranaki.
Yeah, that's correct, on our three-week tour around the North Island.
Yeah, the pleasures of getting on a campaign like this and having to do it on a shoestring, eh?
Absolutely. Totally worth it, though.
Yeah, well, you're still smiling.
Yep, definitely. We had a fantastic time. Great response to the message we were taking out to the community. So, yeah, a bit of discomfort was nothing compared to that.
You've got a decent airbed, have you?
A couple of old mattresses in the back of a truck. Yep, that's all you need.
not even in a tent. No, you're camping in the back of the truck.
That's right, yep.
This wouldn't be Deb's truck by any chance.
That's right, Sheldon.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, well, we better not go into too many details about Deb's truck, I don't think. But it sounds as though it might have a bit of character. Anyway, Maria, I mean, who is Maria Bradshaw? How would you introduce yourself?
I'm Torrin Henry's mum. You know, that's the first thing that always, for me, defines myself. Torrin's my 17-year-old only child who died from suicide on the 20th of March 2008. And in addition to being Torrin's mum, I'm one of the founders of CASPA, Community Action on Suicide Prevention, Education and Research, a nationwide group with a membership of 1,330 families who are working to prevent suicide in New Zealand.
And that number, 1,330 families, that's gone up astronomically because you didn't form this organisation, CASPA, until about, just before the middle of 2010, last year?
August the 12th, 2010. And I recall really vividly on the anniversary this year of Torrin's death, we had just made it to 500 members. So we had 500 in March. Here we are in May and we've got 1,330 members.
Wow. So what does that tell you about the profile that you're building?
Well, you know, it says that largely because of the enormous support we've had from the community and the media, people know about CASPA now. It's a cause that people feel reasonably passionate about. But it also sends a really strong signal about how many people in the community are affected by suicide. We know there are a minimum of 10 suicides a week in New Zealand. 541 families last year affected by this terrible tragedy. And, you know, if you look back over 10 years, that's an awful lot of people who have had personal impact from the self-inflicted death of a loved one.
So, you know, there's been a lot of grief for you, Maria, but what happened immediately after your son Torrin's death 3 years ago?
Torrin's death came completely out of the blue, as it does for so many families. It was the most, you know, by far the most shocking and traumatic thing that's ever happened to me in my life. And one of the things about suicides is that they are often sudden and unexpected. They very, very commonly occur in your own home, particularly when we're talking about children. They are often very violent. And so, like hundreds of other families, I arrived home on what appeared to be any normal day and found my precious, beloved child had suffered a terrible, violent death on his own. Well, at that point, the world just ends. You know, the stars go out, the moon stops shining, the birds stop singing, the world just crumbles around you, and life as you know it is never the same again.
So, the next things that happened were that I guess you fairly soon after became part of the hospital system. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, in the weeks, the days and weeks following Torrin's death, I lost my job. I was medically retired on the grounds that I wasn't fit for work for a period of 12 weeks. So I lost my income. It's one of the things that happens is that almost everybody in my situation contemplates suicide. Why would you not? You've just been confronted with the reality of suicide. Your world has just ended. You know, I often say to people, if your child walked into a forest and fell down a hole, you wouldn't hesitate but to climb down that hole and go and find your child. And suddenly you don't know where your child is. They've just disappeared. And so it's incredibly normal, natural response to contemplate suicide. You want to talk about that with other people. But the moment you do, the mental health system, the justice system swing into place and decide that you must be mentally ill because you're talking about suicide. So, you know, as is the pattern with so many things, a normal human response to a terribly stressful life event is characterised as a mental disorder, and then suddenly you're part of a system that does exactly what you don't need it to do to support your well-being.
So I guess this is one of the myths that exist around suicide, and I think I fell into the trap this morning when I was talking to you about a friend that, or an older man that has approached you, and without revealing any confidences, I had come to the conclusion that perhaps because this person was suggesting he was suicidal, that he would fall in under the mental health system.
Mm.
Now, would you like to just explain that that doesn't always apply? In many cases, it doesn't apply.
Absolutely. Look, you know, research shows that it is incredibly common for people to think about suicide. About 1 in 5 people say they've seriously contemplated suicide. If you're in a situation where something terrible has happened to you, where your life's been turned upside down, of course, as you go through the process of considering what your options are, suicide is going to be one of the ones you consider. Most people probably discount that pretty quickly. But to contemplate suicide is not indicative of a mental disorder. It's actually indicative of the fact that you are going through a process of problem solving. But because in New Zealand, like lots of other countries, we take a really strong mental health approach to distress, rather than looking at it in social terms, we immediately stick a label on somebody, say they're crazy, and throw them into a system which actually promotes more suicidal thinking.
So is that what happened to you, that you virtually got thrown into a medical system that medicated you against this grief and shock?
Thrown literally, Sheldon. I was dragged out of my home around midnight by 5 police officers and a duly authorised officer from the mental health system. When I was asked whether I would voluntarily go to a psychiatric institution because I had publicly talked about contemplating suicide, I said, no, absolutely, I'm not mentally ill. I'm not going to walk into the psych system. And so I was handcuffed. I was, you know, I wasn't resisting or whatever. I arrived at the hospital with severe and extensive bruising that was photographed at the time and was taken straight up for x-rays because they thought that my wrist had been broken during that detention. I was asked to remove all my clothing in front of 2 male security officers because they wanted to take an ECG, and when I refused to remove my clothing, I was tied down. They used leather restraints to tie down my arms and legs and got a pair of scissors and cut my clothing off me and left me naked on the bed in front of the 2 security officers. Now, if that's not going to provoke more thoughts of ending your life, I don't quite know what is.
There's a number of questions there which are somewhat difficult to ask, but how did you come to the notice of the police to the extent that 5 policemen came to your home?
I was living... I'm a single parent, and Torrin and I obviously shared our home, and after Torrin went, I was left at home by myself, and I was very afraid to leave my home, and so my key method of communication with people was via the internet. And there was an awful lot of publicity and discussion about Torrin's death, and of course people would ask me on message boards and blogs and Facebook and things, how are you going, Maria? What's the process for you? What are you thinking? And I would share the fact that, of course, amongst lots of other options, I was also thinking through suicide as an option. My GP called mental health services at that point and...
Without consulting you?
Yes, without consulting.
And how did you feel about that?
Look, I understand what a very difficult position that put my GP in. You know, she was concerned for my welfare, and I'm thankful to her for that. She apologised to me afterwards. She said, I understand that that what I did actually made things worse for you, and there were other ways of doing things. And she's absolutely right. There were far better ways of responding to my distress, my loneliness, my isolation.
But the treatment that you've described when you arrived at hospital is horrific. Has there been any apology or compensation for the way you were treated?
No, absolutely not. And you know, my focus in the 3 years since my son died has been on getting justice for him and accountability from the system for what was done to him. It's been very difficult for me to even be particularly bothered about what happened to me. Because I'm a mother, my focus is on my child. But no, there's certainly been no apology and no compensation for that.
But one of the ironies is that you worked very close to the justice system at one stage in your life.
Yes, that's right. I used to run the High End District Court down in Dunedin and four smaller satellite courts down there. And, you know, I've always had great faith in the justice system that in the end the right thing would be done, and I'm afraid my confidence in the system has been dented enormously by what goes on for mental health consumers where that touches the justice system.
Well, let's come back and talk some more to Maria on this very personal story of hers and her son's death, but we'll take a music break to give everyone a bit of just a break. And we're going to play a track that we have been playing since I attended the Like Minds, Like Minds regional provider seminar. And this is a track called What's This Thing Called Love, and it's actually by the MC of the seminar, and his name is Matthew the Hook de Hooky.
Conditional, is jealousy truly traditional? I know loving yourself is medicinal. What's this thing? What's this thing? What's this thing called love? What's this thing? Thank you.
Yeah, we're back on Take It From Us, and we're talking to Maria Bradshaw, who's the founder of CASPA, which is Community Action Against Suicide. I won't spell out the whole title of it, because it does involve an education element as well, and I think that that's certainly the goal of Maria and coming on Take It From Us, and certainly I would say that there's a lot of lessons to be learnt by Maria's experience. But tell us, Maria, did you end up in hospital?
Yes, I did. I ended up in the acute ward at Auckland Hospital Te Whitu Tāwera because there were no other beds available.
So that's a pretty extreme sort of reaction to, well, all of this is a very extreme reaction to, if you like, some writings on social media.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I'd have to say that an acute mental health ward would probably be the least supportive and healing environment for a bereaved mother. And I know that many of the staff up there were pretty shocked that I'd been taken in and upset.
And I mean, how would you judge your mental health at that time that you walked in the door there?
Look, I was traumatised. I was grieving. I was very alone and very lonely. I had very few social supports. But that didn't make me mentally ill. That made me somebody who was having a normal reaction. Nobody ever asked me, what support do you need? What are the practical things that you need help with? Do you need help doing your grocery shopping? Do you need somebody to sit with you overnight so that you're not alone, and when you wake up having nightmares, you've got somebody there? The reality is, I went in there, they searched through a whole lot of labels to try and put them on me. Adjustment disorder was one of them. This is a few weeks after my son died. I lost my home, lost my income, and they tried to say maybe I had an adjustment disorder. But in the end, the diagnosis was normal bereavement. I was given 5 bottles of psychotropic drugs, benzodiazepines, sleeping pills, antidepressants. And then I was given a taxi chit and sent home to my empty house, again, by myself. No discharge plan, no support. And a couple of days later, of course, I took all those pills.
And had you any understanding of any of those pills previously?
Well, I mean, I'd known that those pills had killed my son, that he had died as a result of treatment-induced psychosis. I was aware that these medications were fatal in overdose, and quite shocked, really, that they would send me home to an empty house with no support, with enough drugs to kill myself a couple of times over.
And I mean, while we're talking about medication, the situation with your son was that it was sort of recommended that he could take an antidepressant, but go off that antidepressant at the weekends and almost given a license to drink alcohol, and quite a lot of alcohol, and then restart the antidepressant. That seems to be quite contrary to what I know about antidepressants.
I know, it doesn't make a lot of sense to us lay people, does it? Again, Torrin had no diagnosis of depression or anything, any other psychiatric disorder. And when he was offered Prozac, he said, but aren't these dangerous with alcohol? I still want to socialise with my friends in the weekend. And so the psychiatrist told him, and recorded in the notes, stop your Prozac on a Friday, drink up to 6 bottles of beer a night over the weekends, and restart your Prozac every Monday. Torrin did that for the 15 days that he lived after they gave him the Prozac, and on day 15 he died.
And Prozac does have a bit of a reputation of encouraging suicidal thoughts and that sort of thing, especially among young people, the bracket of between 14 and 19, where New Zealand has the highest suicide rate in the developed world.
That's right. Prozac and all the other drugs in its class, the SSRIs, have been clinically proven to double the risk of suicide. And there's suggestion that might be particularly for people under the age of 24.
And one of the things that we need to stress is that anyone, listeners out there who hear that, please don't take any drastic action about medication that your teenage sons or daughters might be taking, but just perhaps consult the GP and ask whether there are any risks, and if there are, then whether there are any alternatives.
And look, I back you 100% on that, Sheldon. It was during the withdrawal phase, you know, when my son was coming off the drug on a Friday, that he died. Withdrawal can be really dangerous and needs to be managed very carefully. So don't flush them down the toilet.
Well, that, but also I'm led to believe that antidepressants must be taken as prescribed, and that you can't just sort of pop on them and pop off them as you feel may be good or bad.
No, absolutely not. People do have to be really careful with these drugs. The FDA says that they have the same chemical profile as drugs like amphetamines, methamphetamine, cocaine. These are not things to be played around with. They're, you know, they're really dangerous drugs. And one of the recorded and known side effects is suicidal behaviour and suicidal thinking.
So within 3 weeks, your perception of those authorities that stand up and are respected in our society must have taken a bit of a hammering.
You know, somebody said to me recently on the 20th of March 2008, you were just thrown out of the matrix, weren't you, Maria? You know, everything you'd ever believed in, every value that you upheld was turned upside down and back to front. And that's absolutely the case. I had to reevaluate everything I'd ever learned and believed and trusted.
So to what extent do you think that was sort of discriminating against somebody that was just, well, not just, but was grieving and abandoned?
I think it's a completely inappropriate response. You know, when I was told that I may suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder because I cried a lot after my son died and because I had nightmares after finding him, you know, my response was, it would be a disorder not to suffer those things. That is a normal human reaction. It disturbs me enormously that in the new version of the DSM, grieving for longer than a period of 2 or 3 weeks will be classified as major depressive disorder and, again, treatable by medication. That's denying us our normal human moods and behaviours.
And also it's sort of a bit of a slight on our resilience, if you like, isn't it? I mean, we all have a degree of resilience. As John Reed, our guest 2 or 3 weeks ago, was saying, well, we need, even as part of our character and personality, to be able to come through those without too much sort of, what can we say, medical support.
Yeah, look, honestly, you know, when something like this happens to you, you need a safety net put under you, which is people who will care for you and listen to you and help you with practical things. You do not need a label stuck on you. Drugs that are fatal in overdose and, you know, have all sorts of side effects given to you, you don't need to be made to feel different, unusual, crazy. You need to be supported. Mm-hmm. And what the mental health system does to us after our children die from suicide is the complete opposite of what we need.
So 3 years down the track, are you aware of the sort of support that you needed when you were given a taxi chit from Te Whetu Tauara and told to go back to the North Shore, or driven back to the North Shore into a lonely home on your own with these 5 bottles of pills?
Yeah. The number one thing that families in my position say helps them is contact with other families who have shared the experience. At that point, I had never met anybody else who had lost a child to suicide. I needed desperately to contact those people and to talk to them. I needed support and practical assistance. I had driven up the driveway and found Torrin in our garage. So driving was something I very strongly associated with the trauma. I couldn't go to the supermarket. I couldn't do anything. I needed somebody to help me with that. I had a million practical things to deal with. I had funerals, I had bills, I'd lost my income. The bank were telling me they were going to foreclose on my mortgage. Practical support and assistance.
The other question that occurs to me is that how come you didn't get some sort of compassionate leave, paid leave, from the job that you were doing at the time?
Well, my contract was very clear that if I was unfit for work for a period of 12 weeks, I could be medically retired from my position. And so my employer sent me to a doctor who did an assessment, you know, a doctor of their choosing, who said, no, she's not fit for work for a period of 12 weeks. Who would be? And so they were entitled then to medically retire me.
To terminate your what, within a short period of this happening?
Yeah, look, I don't want to criticise my employer at the time. They obviously, you know, needed somebody in that position doing that job. I wasn't able to give them any assurances when I'd be back to work. I'm more upset about the fact that when I was no longer able to work through no fault of my own, I got a letter from ACC saying if you strained your back getting your child down from the noose, you would be covered by ACC, but if it's just the mental trauma of finding him and having to live the rest of your life without him, you're not covered.
Just the mental trauma?
Yep.
You mean if you had a slight sprain of the back, you would have got some, what, 80% of your income?
That's right. If I was a tourist in New Zealand who twisted my ankle walking the Milford track, then I would be covered as well. But mental trauma is not covered under the ACC legislation because the government, the previous Labor government, decided that there was not enough money to do that. So I was left with no income and no support.
So the grief is compounded by your personal circumstances, which sound as though they're deteriorating very quickly.
Absolutely. You know, what are you supposed to do? It was all I could do to deal with waking up in the morning and remembering every morning that my son was dead, let alone having to worry about how I was going to buy food or pay the mortgage. But there was just nothing there. There isn't for families affected by suicide.
Well, let's take another break, and we're going to take another track from Matthew the Hook to Hookie, who was the MC at the Like Minds, Like Mine National Seminar back in early April, and this one is called Come to Me Now.
Like a metronome, the wind's full of sand like a desert storm. Another wave has come to invade. You need more than a hand to hold on to. Hey, there's a cool fountain inside here. Your desire and not by the fire. You can come to me now. Let me take you into my arms now. Let me show you the love of my heart. I'll quench your desire and not by the fire. You can come to me now. Yeah, you can come to me now. Yeah, you can come to me now. Yet to show, will they make it alive?
one knows the oasis is just a mirage. Yeah. Life feels so hard. There's a cool fountain inside here with mint tea for you and me, so sweet. I'll keep the walls strong for all time. So let me take you into my arms now. Let me show you the love of my heart. I'll quench your desire when not by the fire. You can come to me now. Let me take you into my arms now. Let me show you the love of my heart. I'll quench your desire when not by the fire. You can come to me now. Yeah, you can come to me now. Yeah.
Well, this is Take It From Us, and we're talking to Maria Bradshaw, who is supported by Deb Williams here, and they're both the founders of Casper. And you did, Maria, challenge the legal system, which must always be a very onerous task, to get some answers. What was the outcome there?
Yeah, well, after Torrendite, I realised that this wasn't just a one-off thing that had happened to my child. This happens to thousands of children around the world every year, and that it's promoted by some of the systems that we have. So Torrens inquest, for example, ended up being, I believe, New Zealand's longest inquest, because I wanted every piece of evidence there to give the coroner the best opportunity to recommend changes that could save other children's lives. Well, what happened was that I got charged $70,000 in legal fees and lost my home, and didn't get any recommendations for change at all out of the inquest.
And what sort of changes were you seeking by really taking a stand?
Well, you know, for example, the medication that my son was given is not approved for kids under the age of 18. How many parents know that when their child's handed a prescription? In the United States, it has a huge warning on it saying this can cause suicide, homicide, you know, all sorts of side effects. In New Zealand, no warnings, no nothing. At the very least, I expected that there might be some recommendations for change around that. Telling Torren that he could drink with the medication, I thought that might, you know, all sorts of things that could have changed. But the only thing that really changed was that I lost my home and had to go and live in a garage.
In my experience, there's always a warning about mixing this sort of medication with alcohol. Were you aware of that?
There's no warnings on the box. There's no leaflet in the box. And the pamphlet that I was given by Waitemata District Health Board was found by the Ministry of Health and the coroner to be outdated, misleading and inaccurate. It had none of that information on it, Sheldon. Nothing.
So you made, again, a huge sacrifice to try and bring about change. How were you feeling personally at that point?
Totally gutted. I mean, Torrens inquest lasted for 3 months. I can't tell you how physically and emotionally exhausting it was to have to be in court every day and talk about, you know, or listen to people talk about my son's death and to justify and defend some of the things that they'd done. And then to really get no result from it was devastating, but not devastating enough to make me stop. I mean, there's Health and Disability Commissioner has a complaint from me and is about to look at that. And Casper has recently met with a high-profile lawyer who's looking at a Bill of Rights case on behalf of the families who've lost children in this way.
But so often when we go to a hearing like that, or we're involved in something where we've obviously got a huge personal investment, we hear a lot of things that are inaccurate. How did you cope with the frustration of hearing things that you knew probably were not true?
That was really, really difficult. You know, the amount of times I wanted to jump up in the courtroom and say, that is not true. I'm his mother. Let me show you the evidence. And you can't do that. And you know, there were 30 witnesses. Most of them had never met Torrin. And yet they stood up there and talked about him as though they knew him as well as I did and his friends did. That was really, really hard. I was put on the stand under cross-examination for 4.5 days myself, which I understand is longer than any murderer in New Zealand. Very aggressive cross-examination by 7 teams of lawyers who were on the other side. However, that was my opportunity to have my say. And people thought that was really tough on me, but that wasn't nearly as tough as hearing people talk about Torrin and getting things wrong and not being able to do anything about it.
So what do you think the agenda was here? That this was just an example of the sort of clobbering machine?
Well, some of it was made quite explicit. I mean, for example, when my lawyer complained about the aggressive nature of the questioning, the coroner's response was that because I had been quoted in the media as saying that I was looking at taking manslaughter proceedings against the doctor who didn't obtain fully informed consent from Torrin, that I deserved everything I got under cross-examination. Halfway through the inquest, the coroner also started giving evidence himself, saying that he didn't believe that SSRIs, drugs like Prozac, were associated with suicide. And, you know, I'm not a major conspiracy theorist, but it seemed very clear to me right from the beginning, particularly given that my coroner was a doctor who was involved in the National Women's Cervical Cancer Inquiry, who was found to have experimented on people without fully informed consent, and who was on record as saying he doesn't believe that he did anything wrong. I don't believe I was ever going to get a result from the inquest.
So your feeling in regard to that was there was a fairly severe conflict of interest?
I think there was an absolute conflict of interest in it, and I'm really shocked that that nothing's been done about that. I'm reasonably philosophical about the inquest. I never expected a result, and given that coroners can't find blame, that they can only make recommendations, they can't actually change things. For me, it was an evidence-gathering exercise for the real event, which is Health and Disability Commissioner, and then the Bill of Rights case that we're taking as a class action.
So they are things that you're working on currently that are going to happen down the track?
That's correct, yes.
Right. But do you think that in all of this there is reputations at stake, in that a suicide suggests that somewhere along the line the system has failed?
Look, you know, it was very clear from the beginning that I believed that it was the treatment that killed my child. You know, Torrin didn't have symptoms of depression. All of a sudden, 15 days after these drugs, he's dead. And so a huge amount of resource was put into people defending their own reputations and defending the use of these unapproved medications for children in New Zealand. And people were prepared to throw a huge amount of taxpayer money at defending a process that results in thousands of suicides.
I mean, do you think that the pharmaceutical industry had any part to play in the background?
That's impossible for me to say. I do know that, you know, the mental health system and the pharmaceutical industry are very interlinked. You know, you'll see on the website, for example, for Waitemata District Health Board, they say that they could not run training and conferences and things like that without the support of pharmaceutical companies. Doctors are allowed to accept gratuities and gifts from the pharmaceutical industry. There's no doubt that they have a huge influence on mental health systems and processes in New Zealand.
Well, Professor John Reid, who was the guest 3 weeks ago, touched on this, and his interview has certainly sparked a lot of interest. But he did say that he didn't feel that GPs were sort of taking under the table or under the counter bribes, if you like.
I don't think that at all, but I do know that a group of psychiatrists in the Waikato Shadow have recently rethought the fact that at their monthly meeting, pharmaceutical companies provide the venue, put on morning tea, and in exchange they give them time to promote their latest drugs. Like I said, Waitemata District Health Board, their policy says it's okay to accept gratuities and gifts. People get trips to conferences and exotic locations. It may not be as overt and upfront as it is in the United States, but nobody here thinks that it doesn't happen.
Yeah, we're just going to go to our community notices to give Maria another break and...
Take it from us, Community Notice Board.
Thanks to the Like Minds, Like Mind campaign and framework.
And we're very strongly supporting the initiatives of the Nutters Club. They have a debut season on Maori television, which started on Friday the 13th of May. It's hosted by comedian Mike King, along with resident psychiatrist David Kadaya. So look out for that on Maori television every Friday night at 10:30. It started on the 13th of May. It's the second series in the Nutters Club, and it is, I believe, one of Maori television's highest rating programs. So that's 10:30 every Friday night on Maori television. Look out for the Nutters Club. On the North Shore, there are family and whānau support groups being run by supporting families. The one on the North Shore is the second Thursday of the month. It runs between 7 to 9 o'clock, and it is at the Plunkett Family Centre in Shakespeare Road. That's 213 Shakespeare Road, Milford. It's free, and you can contact supporting families, family and whānau field worker Peter on 44409812. There's also a support group and clinic in West Auckland, and that's the first and third Thursday of the month. This is a support group meets between 10 and 12, and again you can get in touch with Peter on that number, 44409812. So we're talking to Maria Bradshaw, and Maria, I'll have to leave it up to you as to where to go from here, but you've already touched on, I guess, the financial burden of what's happening. Currently you're shifting house. You're shifting out of the garage, eh?
I am shifting out of the garage, yes. I managed to find somewhere that's a bit warmer and a bit drier, you know, for the same price, which is fantastic. And there are two bedrooms, which means I can set up Torrin's bedroom again and have a space with all his things out rather than having them in boxes. I can't tell you what that means to me.
Well, you've got that lights your face up in a big way, so yeah. I can see that that's very significant to you. In terms of discrimination, I mean, there doesn't seem any doubt that you've been severely discriminated against. How does that make you feel?
You know, it makes me really sad that what happened to me happens to 10 families a week in New Zealand, and that we don't seem to be learning the lessons that could be learned. One of the things that really shocked me in Torrens Inquest was a piece of research was presented which is used in the medical school in New Zealand. And it said very clearly, if families criticise the mental health system following the suicide of a child, you need to understand that this is a mental disorder. This is, you know, it's emotional, it's irrational, don't take it seriously.
So that criticism is a mental disorder, is that what you're saying?
That's right. Just like, you know, not taking your medication is treatment compliance disorder or whatever. But we need to be listened to, because we're really clear, our families, what we need after our children die from suicide. And because there are 10 a week in New Zealand, we need to start listening to that and changing what we do.
I think we thought we had a call on the line, but they seem to have gone. But if they want to ring back on 815 8100, they can do that. You know, in mental health, discrimination is really one of the big barriers and obstacles to our recovery. And while you're not recovering from a mental health issue, you're recovering from grief. So is discrimination as big an obstacle?
Yeah, we're certainly, you know, we're treated very differently from people whose children die in illnesses or accidents. And I think that's one of the things that we find really, really tough. You know, the government says that 90.1% of people who kill themselves have a mental disorder. That's absolute rubbish. But I had an anguished mother call me recently and say, if my daughter had died from cancer, she wouldn't be called names. Why is my child being called, you know, in the language used, as a deviant with a mental illness? Why are our children being called names because of the way they died? And as parents, we are treated very differently from other bereaved parents. I really want to say, though, that there is one group out there who our families universally say treat them with kindness, compassion, and a lack of discrimination, and that is funeral directors. Funeral directors in this country, and I don't know about the rest of the world, are the most amazing people. Many of them have grief counsellors, and it's one place where we don't feel that we're bad or wrong or unusual. We are just supported and taken care of.
But, I mean, there's so many people that are touched by death through suicide, isn't there? And my own children had been to funerals of their peers and great friends and that sort of thing. So there's a great awareness of it. But the story that you're telling is that it's all being sort of held underground.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, when we speak out about what happens to us in the mental health system, and believe me, other people's experiences are much worse than mine. You know, when you end up in the mental health system, you have virtually no rights. You can be forcibly injected with drugs that will cause you to become suicidal. You can be given ECT, you know, electric shock treatment against your wishes. The stories we hear are horrendous. But because we're labelled as mental patients, which doesn't happen to people whose kids die in other ways, nobody listens to us, nobody believes us, and we're easily discounted.
So that natural emotional reaction and grief and shock and that sort of thing is what immediately diagnosed as a mental illness?
Absolutely. And, you know, grief, if I'm absolutely sure if you lose a child to illness or accident, it is just terrible. I'm not saying this is worse, but I am saying it's different. We deal with different issues. When we believe, for example, that our children might have made a choice to leave us rather than being taken from us, that as a parent is very difficult to deal with. We have a specific subset of needs. And instead of being written off as over-emotional, crazy mothers and fathers, we actually need to be listened to because we've got some good ideas about what could be done differently.
Well, those good ideas are clearly attracting people into CASPA. You say 1,330 members. You've increased that membership since March in only two short months by about 700 or 800 people.
Yeah.
So there's some positive things happening.
Oh, totally. And one of the most rewarding areas of our work is when we were able to match families up with each other for peer support. So, we match people on age, on the relationship they had with the person who died, on the method of suicide, so that they're talking about as similar an experience as possible. And that is so valued by families and makes us feel that we're really making a difference.
And how can any of our listeners get in touch with you, Maria?
We've got a website, www.casper.org.nz, or if you just go on Google New Zealand and Google CASPA, we should come up first or second. And we also have a Facebook page, and the link to the Facebook page is on the homepage of our website.
Right, and can people communicate, obviously, via the Facebook page? They can express their concerns there. You can respond?
They can, absolutely. And if they want to be a little bit more anonymous than that, then we have forums on the website. So you can register on the CASPA website using whatever username you want and start talking to other people on the CASPA website as well.
And you've got evidence that this is really helping people, providing that support that you so lacked 3 years ago?
Yeah, look, we've got evidence both from research that's been conducted internationally about families saying that this is the best form of support that they get, but also we have hundreds of stories now of, you know, families who've thanked us for putting them in touch with other families. And
so the one of the big challenges is to get some funding to really support this and drive it home. And you've got a plan in September, I think, to what's going to happen then in September.
Yeah, we've chosen World Suicide Prevention Day, the 10th of September, to be the annual fundraising event for CASPA. And so in that week, we are running a March on Parliament on the 8th of September, and we're running a series of community barbecues around the country with the message that connected, cohesive communities are the environments where suicide doesn't flourish and is prevented. We'll be selling CASPA T-shirts, and our big fundraiser is Glow in the Dark CASPA-branded shoelaces.
Wow.
So those should be available through a number of retail outlets and banks. We're just working on that at the moment, but also available at the march and at the barbecues.
So you personally, you're devoting pretty much 24/7 your time?
Yeah, absolutely. This is what I do now. This is what keeps me alive. You know, we talked at the beginning of the interview about how suicide was a very clear option for me. This has given me another option where I can still honour and respect my son and give him the legacy that he would have had if he'd lived.
Well, congratulations to both of you, Deb, for coming along and supporting Maria and for the work that you're doing. I think it's got to be congratulated, and I'm sure you'll go forward from here to a big highlight in September.
Thank you very much, Sheldon.
Thank you, Sheldon.
G'day. Let's take it from us this Tuesday.